Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And starting on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the headline across the top of the page, North Carolina educating doctors, then losing them. This article is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Durham. And along with the article, on the left side, there's a picture of four people in a lab wearing white coats. The caption reads, Doctors in Training at Duke University. Graduates of North Carolina's medical schools tend to not practice medicine in this state. That's especially true for graduates of the two private universities, Wake Forest University and Duke University. Of the 205 medical school graduates from those universities in the class of 2006, only 66 were in training or practicing in North Carolina as of 2011, a retention rate of just 32%. Of all of the graduates from UNC Chapel Hill, 47% stayed in this state. Only East Carolina University had more than half of its 2006 graduates in training or practicing in North Carolina 5 years later. The numbers selected are only for the most recent year available, but previous years have shown similar figures. We are a net importer of medical students, is the way Franklin Walker sums up the situation. Walker is the North Carolina Medical Society's Director of Programs and Practice Management and is married to a pediatrician. He says he remembers traveling from North Carolina to Cincinnati for his wife's residency program, but that it was always their intention to return here. Generally speaking, doctors are more likely to practice in areas where they complete residency training than where they go to school. Before graduation, med students rank their desired residency programs but are assigned based on the National Resident Matching Program, which Walker likened to draft day in a professional sports league. It's understandable that graduates seek out the best residency programs for various specialties, even if those aren't in North Carolina. But it's still somewhat troubling that so many students leave the state, especially when considered that North Carolina has 19.8 physicians per 100,000 residents, compared with the national average of 23.5 physicians per 100,000. A report by Aaron Freyer and Julie Sparrow of the UNC Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research notes that 42% of physicians who take their residencies in North Carolina end up practicing in the state. That ranks in the bottom third of the nation and below the 48% national average. As North Carolina physicians leave the state, international physicians have filled the gap. Since 1990, the percentage of physicians coming to North Carolina from other states and Canada has stayed virtually unchanged, but the percentage of international medical graduates here has increased from 6.6% to 16.7%. Those trends are especially pronounced for primary care physicians. In that same time period, only ECU has substantially increased the number of graduates staying here to practice in primary care, while Wake Forest and Duke have seen that number decline, and UNC has been exactly flat. This data point, which matches national trends, is something that Campbell University officials have long pointed to as a strong reason for their new School of Osteopathic Medicine. Doctors who graduate with these degrees are more likely to become primary care physicians, says Dr. John Kaufman. One reason graduates prefer to go into specialty care is that they offer higher paychecks. But Kaufman says he thinks the medical field is narrowing the gap in physician pay disparity. He points specifically to reimbursement models that incentivize wellness as opposed to treating illness. Right now, we really have a disease care system, he says, as opposed to a health care system. And we move down the page for our next article, which is in the center of the page, has a black border around it. Inside that border, the headline starts at the top. Then there's a picture and the headline continues. The headline, Cooking for the Masses at RDU, Feeding an Airport. Tight spaces mean much of the food cooked off-site. And that picture is a picture of a few people in a kitchen wearing hairnets and aprons. The caption reads, Tim Meyer watches as one of his employees cooks up a batch of hush puppies. And this article is written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Morrisville. You may recognize the names Starbucks and Carolina Ale House, but you probably don't know much about the company that runs those restaurants at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. You also may be unaware that much of their food comes from a common kitchen a quarter mile away, and that the company, HMS Host Corporation, is one of a handful that are in a position to operate new restaurants in Terminal 1 when a large section of it reopens in early 2014 after a renovation. RDU Business Development Director Ingrid Hairston says she plans to put out a request for proposals for the 12 to 14 Terminal 1 restaurant and retail spaces by the end of November. She emphasizes that the airport is open to dealing directly with local restaurateurs and other owners who might have just one or two locations. But the economics of airport food service and the terminal's limited space put special constraints on them. The largest local vendor at RDU, JQ Enterprises Incorporated of Laurinburg, lacks a full kitchen at the airport and runs its restaurants in joint ventures with HMS. HMS spokeswoman Sarah Cody says one in six of the company's restaurants locations nationwide involve partnerships with small businesses owned by women, racial minorities, and people with low net worth as defined by federal guidelines. Meanwhile, HMS and competitors alike have become more aggressive in pursuing franchises with local and regional restaurant chains such as Jason's Deli, Cody says. The airport sets specific criteria for the sorts of restaurants it will seek in Terminal 1, but Hairston says HMS and other large operators can incorporate any such partnerships into their pitches when they respond to the RFP. It's a dynamic and fluid process, she says. HMS prepares most of JQ's food and most of its own food in its remote kitchen on a shift that runs from 3 a.m. to noon. It packages the prepared food in manageable volumes and then chills it down. HMS vans deliver it to the terminal in large runs as needed, usually 12 hours to 4 days after it's first prepared. A smaller kitchen at each individual restaurant brings the food up to temperature with hot water or steam. Meats are usually cooked fresh to order. On a recent Thursday morning, one cook in HMS's kitchen finished up an 80-pound batch of chili, poured it into a 30-gallon plastic tub, and then parceled it into a dozen plastic bags for easy chilling. It was due to be served at HMS's Carolina Ale House franchise in Terminal 2 over the next couple of days. Three chocolate cakes for the Gordon Birch restaurant, a joint venture, had just been pulled from an oven and were cooling on a nearby counter. A few feet away, another cook was working on a humongous batch of hush puppies for the 42nd Street Oyster Bar. The airport franchise is one of just two for the restaurant, whose other location is on West Street in downtown Raleigh. HMS has about 20 people at the airport, including cooks, warehouse employees, and managers, its local director of operations, Tim Meyer, says. The airport has just a few companies like Bethesda, Maryland-based HMS. It and SSP, a British competitor, whose U.S. subsidiary is based in nearby Leesville, Virginia, are the franchisees for most of RDU's restaurants. Similarly, the Hudson Group of East Rutherford, New Jersey, and the Paradise Shops of Atlanta are the airport's leading retailers. Unlike the restaurant companies, they run some of the stores under their own brands. And we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a dateline of Research Triangle Park. The headline, Sense of Place, Top of Vision in Remade RTP. Think retail shops and restaurants, meeting spaces for concerts and films, possibly even apartment buildings, and a high-class hotel. It's all part of the new vision for Research Triangle Park that's evolving through a new master plan adopted by the Research Triangle Foundation's Board of Directors nearly a year ago and finally unveiled to the public this week. RTP officials have also taken the first step in implementing the plan and picked Hines, a Houston-based real estate developer and investment firm, as their partner in the first phase of new development for a mixed-use center planned near the campuses of IBM and RTI International at Davis Drive and Cornwallis Road. We were looking at a number of firms that had the broad, sophisticated experience of something this size and the financial ability to do this, and we have chosen Hines, confirms Bob Giolis, president and CEO of Research Triangle Foundation. The Mixed Use Center, the first of three activity centers recommended within the park, is a central element of the master plan, Giola says, and will be designed to be a destination for people working and living in and around RTP. Smedes York, a longtime member of the board, says there will be a lot of opportunities for developers to get involved with the new plan. The key thing is the repositioning of the park. Companies like Red Hat and Google, a lot of what they are looking for with the younger generation is more urban settings, York says. RTP is not going to ever be truly urban, but it can provide an environment more conducive to the younger generation of workers who are looking for a place where they can exchange ideas and congregate and not be so segmented. Although the specific property for the mixed-use center has not been identified, Giola says he has already contacted representatives of the companies on each property to secure their support. Based on maps from the master plan, the targeted area includes land owned by IBM, RTI International, Syngenta, and several others. I think it's an excellent idea going forward, and one of the things we've been missing, says Wayne Holden, president and CEO of RTI International, a nonprofit research organization that was founded in RTP and employs 2,200 people in the park. We've already agreed to participate and will grant land back if it's identified for this, he says. For more than 50 years, the park had built its real estate foundation on isolated corporate campuses for companies like IBM, GlaxoSmithKline, and Cisco Systems, and the concept had been enormously successful as RTP's roster has grown to include more than 170 companies that collectively employ about 38,000 people in the region. But Holden says companies within RTP have been working in silos for too long, each operating their own cafeteria, their own fitness center, and other employee amenity centers. Anytime I want to go out for lunch, it's at least a 10-minute drive outside the park, and that doesn't mean you'll be rubbing elbows with people working inside the park. We need places where people can cluster, people from 6, 7, 8 different companies in one spot. Based on preliminary recommendations in the master plan, the project could encompass 7 million square feet of building space that would include research-based office space, up to 1,400 apartment units, ground-level retail, a conference center, and hotel and possibly even a science and technology high school. Hines will be taking the lead in conducting market studies and exploring ways to finance the project, Giola says. And the company should already be familiar with the region, since it was chosen earlier this week to spearhead the development of Charlotte's Gateway Station, a 20-acre uptown project billed as Charlotte's version of Grand Central Station. Hines also owns the 12-story Hawk Plaza building on Irwin Road in Durham. We've made great progress this year, Giola says, and we're going to continue on that pace while also taking the time to do it right. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, Leitner winner in $6.2 million he lent for development. Basketballer turned investor Christian Leitner may be struggling to repay a slew of loans from friends and various professional athletes, but he got a break in October when a judge ruled that he's entitled to get back $6.2 million that he himself had loaned out. Leitner made the loans to a group of real estate ventures that he co-owned with Duke University teammate Brian Davis and a third investor, which developed the West Village project in downtown Durham. The project stalled midway, and Leitner began to demand repayment in 2010. Leitner, who starred at Duke University, sued the company in Superior Court in early October. Within hours, an attorney for the defendants acknowledged the debt, and Judge Robert Hobgood entered the $6.2 million judgment on October 10. The Carolina Hurricanes locker room received $300,000 in upgrades during the offseason, part of $1 million in renovations at the PNC Arena. That's nice, but there's just one catch. Because the NHL is still in a lockout, none of the players have seen their new digs yet. That means no one else gets to either. According to the hockey team's policy, no one is allowed to see the locker room before the players do. Just one more reason Biz hopes this greedy argument ends soon. Retirement didn't last long for Lee County's longtime economic development director, Bob Hutes. Hutes, who resigned from his post in Lee County on October 1, has been hired as economic development director for Beaufort County. North Carolina Department of Commerce Secretary Keith Crisco was in Washington, North Carolina on November 1 to speak to the Beaufort County Committee of 100, which also happened to be Hute's first day on the job. Hute, who moved to the Triangle in 1969 to play basketball for NC State University, notified the Lee County Economic Development Corporation in August that he would retire from the organization that he had led for 16 years. The Beaufort County Economic Development Commission had been seeking a new director since former director Tom Thompson resigned in June. Max Rule in Chapel Hill. Through a program known as the Carolina Computing Initiative, students can get financial aid grants to buy a computer of their choice. And this year, 60% of students with a CCI grant chose an Apple MacBook, with 40% going for the other choice, a Lenovo laptop. Last year, the two brands were even at 50-50. Cree Incorporated is taking on a new role, that of artist. The Durham Lighting Company is teaming with the Raleigh Convention Center to demonstrate its technology and artistry through the Cree Energy Efficiency Icon Art Installation. The symbols, which went up this month in the walkway that leads from the RCC to the Raleigh Marriott City Center, were created to denote various types of energy-saving technologies, from solar farms to the LED lighting that is Cree's forte. Downtown Cary will be transformed into a golf course for one day on November 25 for disc golf, that is, as the town co-sponsors the first ever urban disc golf tournament in the region, dubbed Downtown Urban Open. Disc golf participants will play on a temporary course with holes placed in, through, and off the town's parking deck at Town Hall and all around major Town Hall campus structures. Participation is open to both amateurs and professionals. It is also being sponsored by Cary Area Disc League and Raleigh Area Disc League. Brides-to-be and local event planners now have two new venues in the Triangle where they can host weddings and other events. Beltline Station in Durham and Cardinal Hall in Raleigh are the latest ventures by Todd Aldred and Michelle Aldred, owners and founders of Triangle Catering, who opened the Cotton Room event space in Durham in 2009. Beltline Station is near the Cotton Room in the historic brick N&W Beltline Depot at the Cordoba Center for the Arts. The depot has a history dating back more than 100 years in Durham. Also taking a page from history is the new Raleigh venue Cardinal Hall on Lead Mine Road in the Wake County Shrine Club building. Virginia Parker, Associate Executive Director for Wake Tech Community College Foundation, has received the 2012 Vernon Malone Friend of Education Award, which recognizes a Wake County citizen who has demonstrated exceptional commitment to the betterment of public education. A Raleigh resident for more than 30 years, Parker is responsible for identifying, cultivating, and developing strategic partnerships that bring private support and resources to Wake Technical Community College. The award was presented at the 2012 Education Summit put on by the Wake Education Partnership. Steve Parrott, the partnership's president, and others informed the local business community about new national educational standards, in part through a mock classroom algebra lesson in which summit participants were students. NC State University will be an official talent partner for Volvo Group, giving students increased internship, mentorship, and employment opportunities with the car company. The partnership gives students a leg up if applying with Volvo after graduation, and it gives the company access to research and talent at the university. As part of the program, the Volvo Group, headquartered in Gothenburg, Sweden, will participate in career fairs and offer students co-op, internship, and mentoring opportunities with the company's various business divisions. NC State's outstanding engineering and design programs make them an ideal partner for the Volvo Group. Torbjörn Holmström, Volvo Group Chief Technology Officer and Executive Vice President of Volvo Group Trucks Technology, says in a statement, "The technical programs at NC State seemingly align with the needs of the Volvo Group as we look to achieve our vision of becoming the world leader in sustainable transport solutions with pioneering products and services." Durham-based Open Software Integrators has partnered with the Shared Learning Collaborative the Council of Chief State School Officers, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and the Carnegie Corporation of New York to create an open-source teaching tool project. The collaborative is testing a shared technology infrastructure to help provide teachers with the instructional data and tools they need. Two PGA Tour golfers, one living in Raleigh and one raised in Raleigh, are joining together to purchase a piece of property on the corner of Blunt and Bragg Streets downtown for use by Neighbor to Neighbor, a mentoring and community outreach organization. Reigning U.S. Open champ Webb Simpson, who grew up in Raleigh and now lives in Charlotte, and five-time PGA Tour winner Carl Peterson, who played golf at NC State University and now lives in Raleigh, say they wanted to make a personal commitment to Neighbor to Neighbor and its work in Southeast Raleigh. The contribution will be celebrated with a dinner on November 13 at Neighbor to Neighbor, with Simpson's 2012 U.S. Open trophy on display. Then the next morning at 8:30 at Raleigh Country Club, Simpson and Peterson will hold a skills demonstration and golf event to raise money for the charity. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun, Chris Bagley, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, and Lauren Onsorge. And now we turn to a section in the Triangle Business Journal. That's a series of small articles, all under the title Bracing for Change. And on the first page, there's a large picture of President Barack Obama at the podium giving the speech after winning the election. The caption reads, "It was a long and grinding road leading up to Election Day. Now the results are in. TBJ's reporters asked the most important question, what do they mean of local and national business leaders by industry sector? Here's what they say." And first, we'll start with real estate. And the subheadline on this one, a solution to nation's debt problem vital for planning. President Obama has renewed his lease at the White House for another 4 years, but many Triangle real estate executives are skeptical that the deal will reap a lot of immediate dividends for the real estate community. Most are hinging their bets on the adoption of some form of the Simpson-Bowles plan, named after North Carolina native Erskine Bowles and former U.S. Senator Alan Simpson, who co-chaired the President's Deficit Commission in 2010. The plan aimed at reducing the federal deficit by cutting spending and raising taxes, but was never put to a vote in Congress. Smedes York, a Raleigh businessman who has been involved in local politics and just about every form of real estate brokerage, management, and investment in the region, notes that adoption of the Simpson-Bowles plan could help bring more clarity among business executives regarding the future costs of business. "I think it's critical because it cuts across party lines," York says of the plan. "Real estate flourishes when an economy flourishes, when companies are investing, and people have confidence. Erskine Bowles is from right here, and I'd love to see him get some position that makes this thing happen." Greg Sandruder, president of the Hamilton Merritt real estate development firm based in Cary, notes that not everyone will like all aspects of the Simpson-Bowles plan. "But at least we would know what we would be getting," he says. "Our industry provides a home for business and industry across the country, and we haven't heard a lot of optimism from business executives over the last 4 years," Sandruder says. "If the businesses were not wildly optimistic about the future on November 5th, why would they be wildly optimistic about the future on November 7th? Ed Frisch, president and CEO of Highwoods Properties, based in Raleigh, agreed, noting that pain today is much better than the pain we will have if we don't do something today. "We are so dependent on so many other industries that we've all become victim to the gridlock of uncertainty," he says. "I'm hoping it will change." Frisch says that Highwoods was able to grow its employee base about 3% in 2012 through its expansion into the Pittsburgh market, but he also noted that those were not new jobs created for that community because most of the staff hired came from the previous manager of those properties. And the next section is healthcare, subheadlined, "While Opposition Remains, Obamacare is on its way." Obamacare came out of Tuesday's election as one of the winners, and many of the law's provisions will begin to take place during President Obama's second term. Since it was signed into law in 2010, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act was the topic that received nearly ubiquitous criticism from Republicans, with presidential candidate Mitt Romney promising to begin working to repeal provisions in the act on his first day in office. An Obama victory means the provisions will begin to go into effect in 2013 and 2014. Indeed, as Timothy Jost, a columnist for the academic journal Health Affairs, reports, many of those provisions will begin to become part of the lives of many Americans. One of the more immediate effects of Obamacare will be the expansion of Medicaid, which currently covers only a small portion of the extremely poor. The Affordable Care Act increased eligibility to anyone who earns up to 138% of the poverty level, or about $15,000 for an individual and $31,000 for a family of four. North Carolina Health News has called the Medicaid expansion the cornerstone of the law because it extends health insurance to the working poor. And our next section is technology. Too much uncertainty creates extreme unease. From the big guns to the startups, the watchword in the technology sector following the election is uncertainty. Take Lord Corporation, the Cary-based company that works on technology in everything from aerospace to adhesives. Its CEO, Rick McNeil, says there are a lot of questions today, not just for technology and manufacturing, but for the entire economy. There's huge uncertainty in putting together a 2013 plan due to the potential of sequestration and the largest tax increase in U.S. history, he says, adding that other issues the election brought to light include continued challenges with overregulation, limits on immigration of talented foreign students that can't get visas to stay in the U.S., passing a free trade agreement with Russia, and developing an energy policy that develops our oil and gas resources and eliminates our dependency on Middle Eastern oil. On the smaller end of the spectrum is Cary-based Strike Iron, an e-commerce company fronted by CEO Sean O'Leary, who also says there's some uncertainty. I will need to fully understand the increased costs, tax burden of the current healthcare legislation will have on our company before I can hire any new employees in 2013, he says. While he doesn't believe Congress will let the country go off a fiscal cliff, he does worry they will use this as a bargaining chip as they negotiate what to cut, which could scare the markets, resulting in more instability in the U.S. and world economies, which is not good for anyone. Brooks Rayford, CEO of the North Carolina Technology Association, had some advice for North Carolina Governor-elect Pat McCrory. I would encourage him to work with legislative leaders to pursue his campaign goals of tax and regulatory simplification, as well as streamlining of government operations through effective use of technology, Rayford says. I'd also share with him that the tech community wants strategic and meaningful investments in education and workforce training to be high priorities, even as efficiencies are sought. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first article, bankers say demand rising for their foreclosure books. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dayline of Raleigh. Managers of Yadkin Valley Bank say they see upswings in demand and in sale prices for various types of foreclosed real estate, an indication of better times ahead. CFO Jan Holler says Yadkin, which owns the Cardinal State franchise in Durham, has been able to wipe more than $2.5 million in foreclosed residential property off its books in the past 3 months. Known in the banking sector as OREO, O-R-E-O, for other real estate owned, such assets are considered low quality because they're difficult to value precisely and because they don't generate significant income for banks. Moreover, Holler says the bank's recent sale of a piece of commercial real estate showed prices jumping 10% in the last month. We have been seeing a great deal more activity, especially in the residential area, Holler says. Asked if she thought the recent record marked a turnaround, Holler says simply, "I think it does. I wouldn't dispute that." Yadkin has $1.9 billion in assets and does business in 33 North Carolina counties, from Mountainous Avery and Ash to Durham and the Triangle. It's a wide footprint that gives the bank exposure to most of the state's key real estate markets. As part of a new $45 million recapitalization plan, the bank sold preferred stock convertible into common shares to 43 investors and plans to wipe $67 million in problem assets off its books by the first quarter of 2013, CEO Joe Towell says. Towell dubs it an effort to create an improved credit profile. Of the $67 million, $50.5 million is in the form of troubled loans. The remaining $16.5 million is foreclosed real estate, mostly raw land that is scattered throughout the bank's footprint and that was originally intended for residential and other construction. Property that has been on Yadkin's books for some time will be shed at fire sale prices, Holler says, declining to elaborate on where the land is or how deep the bank believes the discounts will turn out to be. It's the worst of the worst, she says. Whatever the Yadkin experience, in the Triangle anyway, Alan Tate real estate agent Tom Bowman says raw land is selling, especially land that was improved with infrastructure before going into foreclosure. In that case, it's selling well, though not a peak year prices, Bowman says. Farmland is going for about $5,000 to $7,000 an acre, when it had been going for $10,000 to $15,000, he says. I think it's dropping to about where it should be. Bowman's residential practice includes OREO sales, and similar to what Yadkin Valley Bank managers report, such sales are becoming more frequent and at improving prices, he says. We're now getting better than 80 cents on a dollar, he says, and with the average time on the market now about 110 days for all existing homes, OREO is going quicker than that, says Bowman. The banks know what they have, and it's all starting to move. Tax changes let firms take quick deductions for repairs. That's the headline on our next article, this one written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. Business owners who have made major repairs to their facilities over the past 4 years can take a new deduction on federal taxes for 2012. Managers at Triangle accounting firms have gotten busy in recent weeks familiarizing clients with the IRS's new repair regulations. They are lengthy and complicated, and many business owners will require an assist to get to the bottom of them. And now is the optimum time to start planning, says Carolyn Abbott, a tax specialist with the Raleigh-based accounting firm of Thomas, Judy, and Tucker. One part of the changes covers big-ticket repairs, such as re-roofing a place of business or an apartment building, or the installation of new HVAC or similar systems. In the past, for tax purposes, companies depreciated the cost of such repairs over time. In the case of commercial properties, the depreciation time was up to 39 years, for rental properties, 27.5 years. Under the IRS rewrite, business owners who made repairs during or after 2008 are now able to write off the entire underappreciated balance of repair costs on their 2012 or 2013 tax bills. In some cases, we're talking about a lot of money, says Abbott. Another important component of the new regulations includes changes to the so-called de minimis expensing rule. De minimis is a Latin expression meaning about minimal things. If a business expenses the cost of acquiring a property for financial reporting purposes, it can deduct the amount for tax purposes up to a certain amount. All types of materials and supplies also are eligible for the de minimis rule under the new regs. The IRS first outlined the changes, which also include a number of other rules governing expenses incurred in selling, acquiring, producing, and improving tangible assets in December 2011. The agency, as recently as September, was still issuing clarifications as to how they are supposed to be implemented. In fact, the very complexity of the new regulations has prompted some critics to claim they are too dense. Among them are the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, AICPA, whose Associate Chief Counsel, Andrew Kiso Jr., recently fired off a 42-page letter asking the IRS to provide illustrative examples of how the new regulations are supposed to operate. AICPA spokesman Jonathan Cox says he can't comment on whether the IRS's recent clarifications addressed all of his group's concerns. What is without question, however, is the fact that they will impact a wide variety of businesses. And this is certainly true of companies in the real estate area, says Thomas, Judy, and Tucker's John Broadfoot. That firm is busy combing through its client list to see which of them will be impacted by the new repair regs and how. And our next article, written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Morrisville, the headline, Businesses Pressure Lawyers to Limit Costs. Under pressure to cut costs, companies are pushing their law firms to reduce rates and adopt new billing structures, as well as assigning more work to their own in-house attorneys. In a November 5 survey by Philadelphia-based consulting firm Altman Weil, nearly half of the company's chief legal officers, CLOs, said they have been farming out less work to outside firms than in years past. Firms usually emphasize their attorney's expertise, which is often narrowly specialized, as a prime selling point, and their attorneys tend to earn substantially more and do work somewhat longer hours than in-house attorneys. Asked to choose from 10 improvements that outside firms should make, CLOs listed greater cost reduction as the most important, three other cost-related options rated among the top five choices. While the focus on legal costs first became acute during the 2007 to 2009 recession, the Altman Weil survey and interviews with Triangle attorneys indicate that it is sharpening even now as the economy gains steam. More than half of the CLOs in the survey say they would like their outside firms to move away from hourly billing, the practice that defined corporate legal costs for most of the profession's modern history. They're looking to increase their value, Rob Van Arnman, an intellectual property attorney at Williams Mullen in Raleigh, says of corporate clients. This is a new function of the legal relationship. This doesn't go away with the improved economy. Managers at some law firms say they're trying to get out ahead of clients' push to reduce costs. Some firms also say they're putting new emphasis on bidding for pieces of legal work. GlaxoSmithKline, the British drug giant, whose North America operations are headquartered in Research Triangle Park, began an aggressive push for alternative fee arrangements in 2008 when Dan Troy took over as general counsel. Associate General Counsel Bob Harshett says the company is continuing that push. While attorneys say such large global companies have been particularly aggressive in that push, it's also beginning to catch on among smaller companies, Harshett says. Business attorneys, both in corporate legal departments and at the outside law firms, say they're still trying to discern the new normal in the legal services market. The changes can be tough for firms, particularly for big ones. They say a dozen business attorneys in the Triangle cited the big firm, small firm contrast last summer when they broke away to form the Morningstar Law Group in Morrisville. Founding partner Ken Carroll, who left Womble Carlyle, says large firms tend to raise their stated hourly rates every year, but end up offering ever larger discounts to many of their clients. The process has come to seem like a game, Carroll says. It's kind of funny, he says. And our next article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Bun. The headline, Getting Juice from Rural Farms to Grid, a Kink in Solar Hose. In some cases, infrastructure improvements are needed to move electricity into the pipeline. And along with this article, there's a large picture of some solar panels, and the view is looking up with the sun in the background. The caption reads, Solar arrays are being built in rural areas where land is less expensive. The unexpectedly swift growth of North Carolina's solar industry is posing challenges for developers and utilities as they shoehorn ever larger projects into the far corners of the state's power grid. Developers completed only a couple of projects in the range of 5 megawatts in 2011. More than a dozen have been proposed and completed in 2012, including one in Bunn that began generating in mid-October. The larger plants have to be connected to the broader electrical grid with larger and heavier cables, transformers, and other gear. Argand Energy Solutions LLC looked into the possibility of developing a 5-megawatt solar farm at a site in Warren County, but ran into difficulties because of its size and the 6 miles to the nearest electrical substation, CEO Eric Lynch says. Upgrading the 6 miles of electrical cables and other gear would have added $800,000 to the project's $5 million cost, Lynch says. That was a deal killer, says Lynch, whose company's two offices are in Charlotte and Durham. Federal and state utility regulations also come into play. Detailed studies are required when a planned solar facility's generating capacity is greater than 15% of the maximum load on the circuit. For example, a National Association of Solar Companies has asked for changes to that rule. In some parts of rural North Carolina, developers say the growing number of solar farms of 1 to 5 megawatts capacity is also forcing developers to choose their sites more carefully or pay to upgrade electrical infrastructure that would otherwise be maxed out. One set of expensive upgrades involves the large circuit breakers that protect parts of the grid against overload, says Tommy Cleveland, an engineer with the North Carolina Solar Center. When you have several large systems or one really large system, you start to have to make changes to those protection devices, Cleveland says. People in the industry point to the area around Rockingham, Laurinburg, and Lumberton as having the heaviest concentration of solar farms and therefore posing the biggest challenges to developers. It's relatively flat, inexpensive land is good for solar farms, but the rural setting also makes electrical infrastructure the limiting factor, people in the industry say. In Bunn, about 40 minutes northeast of Raleigh, the photovoltaic panels spread out across more than 20 acres, generating 4.5 megawatts at times of peak sunlight. The facility is across the road from a 500-inmate prison, so the electrical infrastructure there required no major upgrades, say representatives of the installer Power Secure Solar. But developers have registered at least 320 megawatts of proposed generating capacity statewide. That's enough to power roughly 32,000 homes at times of peak production, and the number of commercial solar arrays has grown large enough to begin jostling up against a range of rules set by local governments, Duke Energy Corporation, and its Progress Energy Carolina subsidiary. Statewide, solar generating capacity has grown from about 275 megawatts in July and from about 125 megawatts in late 2011. Some local zoning requirements dictate that solar facilities be located certain distances from one another, typically a mile or two, developers say. Duke and Progress also discourage developers from locating generating facilities so close to one another, Lynch says. At its annual conference, the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association brought in Duke's Director of Renewable Energy Strategy, Emily Felt, to discuss such connection issues. And as we continue reading in the Triangle Business Journal, our next article has the headline, New CEO Bought In, Tweaks Focus as Hedge for Revenue. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a Dateline of Durham. And above the article, it has a picture of three people standing in a lab. The caption reads, Vijendra Nalamathu, Chris Burkett, and Ryan Klein look over research work at Tergus. That's T-E-R-G-U-S. Big Pharma vet Vijendra Nalamathu has made a big bet on Tergus Pharmaceuticals. After becoming familiar with the company, Nalamathu, an 18-year industry veteran, bought a 50% stake in the company, previously called Analytical Solutions Incorporated, and took over as CEO. Now, as Tergus prepares to relocate into a 11,563-square-foot space on Meridian Parkway, Nalamathu is giving the company a makeover by adding drug development capabilities that could lead to royalties. The company now operates as a clinical research organization, or CRO, earning its money on service contracts. It's an extension of a CRO, Nalamathu says. The company plans to develop topical medicines on its own and with partner companies, but instead of putting all its resources into drug candidates that could succeed or fail, the company will keep taking CRO contracts and be able to provide expanded services with double the lab space in the new building. The drug development won't get going until March 31, when the relocation happens. It's push and pull, Nalamathu, former global head of dermatology research at Promius Pharma, a subsidiary of the Indian company Dr. Reddy's, says of Tergus's new strategy. You pull products from the client when they have a project, and we execute them and give it back. Tergus would benefit from royalties and other fees. When conflicts arise, such as a customer working on a model similar to a Turgis compound, a deal might not happen, at least not until Turgis has protected its own technology with patents. Nalimathu attributes future success to the niche model, saying there are only two or three CROs that focus on topical medicines. Topicals are lotions and ointments that are applied directly to the tissue they're intended to treat. Customers are already requesting the services Turgis will soon offer, Nalimathu says. To explain the expansion, Chris Burkett, Director of Quality Assurance and Compliance, walks through the lab at the company's current location. Currently, she says, pointing to a row of test tubes, we answer questions about our products. Answers include what happens to a specific cream if it overheats and how much of a compound is delivered into the skin. Just because a cream has a certain amount of drug doesn't mean all that drug gets into the body. We test that and measure it here, she says, adding that such research is why labels of ointments might contain warnings about heat. Nalimathu, who relocated from New Jersey to renovate the company, is excited, but even he can't match the enthusiasm of Turgis president Kayla Stacker, who started the company in 1994. We've been organically growing over the past 18 years, she says. The new Turgis will take the company to the next level to grow in a way that we are able to now produce development services. But not too fast, Nalimathu says. We're in no hurry. The company is not courting investors and instead is growing organically, planning to have a 20-person headcount over the next year. The new headquarters can house up to 40 scientists, Nalimathu says. After developing its own drugs, Turgis plans to have them manufactured by San Antonio, Texas-based DPT Labs. And now, as we continue with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll return to some of the short articles in the Bracing for Change section, where TBJ reporters asked some of the local industry leaders, what do the election results mean? And now we'll continue with the banking sector, with the subheadline, depending on size of institution, outcome offers many meanings. Analyzing the effects of Tuesday's election on the banking industry means taking it layer by layer. At the top, among the big banks represented in the triangle by the likes of Bank of America, BB&T, and PNC Financial Services Group, the prime significance of a second Obama term will mean more Dodd-Frank financial reform. As enacted, Dodd-Frank was a shell of a law, charting out the major thrust of reform but leaving hundreds of detailed rules to be negotiated. In November, for example, Federal Reserve, FDIC, and Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, OCC, finally published their final rules on bank stress testing. That's the exam mostly on big banks on whether they have adequate capital vis-a-vis their obligations to withstand major downturns in the housing markets and other economic measures. The New York law firm of Davis Polk & Wardwell keeps a running tally of the Dodd-Frank rulemaking process. As of November 1, it reports a total of 237 Dodd-Frank rulemaking deadlines have passed. Of those 237 past deadlines, 144, or 61%, have been missed, and 93, or 39%, have been met with finalized rules. And that may be a typo. It may be 39%, 39 or 39%. In addition, 133 of the 398 total required rulemakings have been finalized, while 132 rulemaking requirements have not yet been proposed. Major rulemaking activity this month included the Federal Reserve, FDIC, and OCC final rules on stress testing. Additionally, the SEC proposed a rule on capital, margin, and segregation requirements for swap dealers and major swap participants. And in the section on transportation, foreign ownership of airlines rises as an issue. Analysts said Wednesday that President Barack Obama's reelection may settle several questions that have been hanging over transportation companies, including the possibility that a Mitt Romney administration might have pushed to eliminate a cap on foreign ownership of airlines. Federal law has capped foreign ownership since 1926, when the aim was to foster what was then a fledgling industry. The original 49% cap was later tightened to a 25% cap that applies only to voting shares. Several proposals to relax the cap have been floated in Congress over the years, including a Bush-era proposal to move the cap back to 49%. While Romney himself said little about such proposals, people in the industry looked for him to push for a lifting or elimination of the cap. Such expectations were widespread, said Bob Mann, an airline industry consultant in Port Washington, New York. The argument is that the cap limits investment, Mann said. The counter to the argument is, why would anyone be interested? He added, only half in jest. The industry has been in choppy sky since 2001, with multiple recessions and rising fuel costs. Nearly all major airlines to survive have done so with the help from bankruptcy reorganizations, and the industry has consolidated considerably in attempts to gain pricing power vis-a-vis suppliers and passengers. And in higher education, the subheadline, White House expected to push for more student aid. With President Obama in office for a second term, it's likely he will push hard to expand federal aid to college students, including policies that strengthen Pell Grants. This program, which gives grant money to low- and middle-income families to help high school graduates afford college, has been one that Obama has had high on his agenda since taking office in 2008. Already, the president raised the maximum Pell Grant award for the 2013-2014 school year to $5,635, a $905 increase since 2008. In addition, the number of Pell Grant recipients has expanded by 50% over the same time. North Carolina will see its share increase. In 2011, the federal government awarded $913 million in Pell Grants to eligible students. Estimates show that will increase to $931 million this year and $951 million by 2013. And now as we continue reading the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to the trianglebusinessjournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Duke Energy's surprise CEO ouster proved an effective tactic. Newly released documents show that whatever the merits of Duke Energy's decision to oust Bill Johnson as CEO, tactically the surprise announcement was a success that left Johnson supporters shocked and in disarray. The move immediately after Duke's $32 billion purchase of Progress Energy was unexpected. Duke arranged to have that first meeting July 2nd, at which Johnson was elected CEO, and then his resignation was demanded by telephone. That left the five former Progress directors who participated unable to coordinate any effective response through the night, while most of the world remained unaware of the boardroom coup that had placed Jim Rogers at the head of the company he was slated to hand over to Johnson. Grifols job losses lowered to 51. An impending lab closure at Grifols, spelled G-R-I-F-O-L-S, might not mean as many local job losses as previously reported. That's according to a notice filed Tuesday with state employment officials showing 51 permanent job losses at a local plasma lab. This is old news, spokesperson Becky Levine said via email, adding that the notice was for the already reported plasma testing facility closure, a closure that she had said in April would result in the loss of about 100 local jobs. Levine offered no immediate comment in addition to what was posted in the notice. She had said the test lab would be phased out through December and was part of an overall Grifols consolidation plan, one that's been in the works since before last year's acquisition of Research Triangle Park-based Tailcris. MLM shares rise on earnings growth. Shares of Martin Marietta Materials Incorporated shot up 5% Tuesday morning after the company reported unexpected strong growth in revenue and profit in its aggregates business. Raleigh-based Martin Marietta was trading at $89.16 at mid-morning, just shy of a 12-month high. The company reported revenue of $594 million in the third quarter, up 21% from the third quarter of 2011. In part, that growth reflected the acquisition of new operations in Colorado last year. Bankruptcy filings continue to fall. Bankruptcy activity continued to slow in October in Wake County as fewer debtors sought relief from their creditors. A total of 214 Wake County debtors filed initial petitions in U.S. bankruptcy court for the Eastern District of North Carolina, according to statistics compiled by the court. The monthly count was down by 5% from October 2011 and has been mostly falling since mid-2010. The filers last month were overwhelmingly individuals and couples with few or no businesses in the mix. Carmanos gets new role at CompuWare. Carolina Hurricanes owner Peter Carmanos will have more time for hockey. The former CEO of the software company he founded, CompuWare, is stepping down as executive chairman of its board, according to securities filings. The company, which has an operation at Durham's American Tobacco campus, will transition him to a consultant role in which he'll make $600,000 a year. And in our remaining time, we'll read as much of the Washington briefs by Kent Hoover that we can. Spending hit $6 billion. Spending on this year's elections hit a record $6 billion, thanks to nearly $1 billion spent by groups that aren't connected, at least officially, with campaign or political parties. That's according to the Center for Responsive Politics. In the new campaign finance landscape post-Citizens United, we're seeing historic spending levels spurred by outside groups dominated by a small number of individuals and organizations making exceptional contributions, says Sheila Krumholtz, the center's executive director. Spending by outside groups accelerated up until the election. In September, these groups spent about $19 million a week, according to the center. By the week of October 21, they were spending $70 million a week. Businesses helped victims. Businesses have pledged more than $86 million towards Hurricane Sandy relief efforts, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Business Civic Leadership Center. That includes cash, in-kind contributions, and employee and customer matching campaigns. The private sector has just really stepped up, said Jeannie Moore, senior advisor at the private sector office of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And we'll stop right there. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.